morning, everyone. Today's Daf Yitzivos is Daf Samech Vav. We begin today the sixth parak of the Masechta. Just a good mnemonic. It's page 66, sixth parak. It kind of works out well. Rashi and Tosfos have a debate which parak actually belongs here. You'll find this every now and then within Shas, that sometimes parakim are not agreed to which parak should go where. Megillah, for example, parakim 3 and 4 are switched. Switch meaning that in the Mishnah they come out one way, and in the Gemara they come out another way. And it wasn't said with absolute precision which parak belongs where. We don't have to worry. We have a Vilna Shas. It's kind of been decided for us. So we're going to be starting the parak entitled Mitzias Aisha. Thank the Lupin Foundation for sponsorship of the Daft Office. Anyway, if you want to see some of the issues in terms of which why maybe we should be learning not the sixth parak, but rather the seventh parak, so you could see Tosfos on the parak for that discussion. But we're going to go right into the Mishnah and right into the Masechta. We start with the Mishnah, Mitzias Aisha, Masi Adela Baala. Information that we've already seen earlier in the Masechta. In fact, the Gemara is going to note that this is not news. This is, as we are now in Ksuvos, and we are well into Ksuvos, we're learning already the 66th page of the Masechta. So we knew this already, and the Gemara is going to point that out. But just to translate, the findings of a woman go to her husband. So in the structure of a marriage, so we know that there's a lot of quid pro quo, there's a lot of exchange, and one of the exchanges is that occurs in the marriage is that she finds something, so that goes to the husband. So Masi Adela Bala, and also her earnings go to the husband as well. And it's kind of funny, of these two points that are made, which again, I know they're repeated points, they're points that we've seen already, of the two points that are made, Masi Adela, you'd figure to be the more... the more basic point, meaning Masi Adeha, her earnings go to her husband. So the Gemara says a number of times that that's an exchange. It's an exchange for a mizonos. So in fact she can say to her husband, you know, you keep your mizonos, I'll keep my Masi Adeim. But Masi Adeim is just some maybe you'd call it like a more basic halacha. But anyway, but still the idea is that these two things go to the husband. Good. Yerusha Sa. So what about something that she inherits? What is that in reference to? So if you take a look at Rashi over here in the Mishnah. So Rashi writes, the first Rashi on the parak. Rashi writes, Imnimtsa, sorry. Okay, glasses are off. There we go. Imnafala Yerusha, hu ochapers bechayev ekeren shalom. So one pshat that Rashi offers is, let's say she gets a Yerusha after she's married. She has a father who dies, an uncle who dies. In other words, somebody who dies and she's a benefactor. She receives the inheritance. So what happens to that? So in the structure of marriage, now she's a married woman. So that means as follows. Obviously, the title of the item is hers, meaning that she is the owner of whatever Yerusha she gets. But the husband's entitled to peros. So land that she gets after she gets married, so the husband's entitled to peros. We would call this, generally speaking, in the world of marriage, nichzim maluk property. Maluk property is property that's owned by her, but the husband is entitled to the dividends of that property. So that could be true at the beginning of a marriage, which we already discussed earlier. And it's also true in a marriage as well. So in other words, while she's married, she gets property. Property comes to her as a Yerusha. Yerusha is just an example. Could be somebody's gifting her the property as well. Either way, and now she obviously is the owner of the property, but the husband gets the payros. That's that's one pshat that Rashi offers. Rashi offers another pshat in the Mishnah, Lishna Achrina, the Imeitha Bechayav Yersha. Husband inherits the wife. Another possible explanation of what our Mishnah means. We're going to stick right now with the first one, as it fits in a little bit better with the continuation of the Mishnah. Back to the Mishnah. Hu ochapers bechayeha. So he eats the payros while she's alive. Okay, so that first pshat works a lot better into the Mishnah. Second pshat, a little bit difficult, meaning we're talking about he yarshining her, so why would the Mishnah then point out while she's alive, he gets the peros? Okay, either way. Boshto pagama shalom. Okay, what if she gets assaulted while she's married? Okay, somebody else assaults her while she's married. So as we know, the eighth parak of Baba Kama teaches us that she's entitled to five payments. Anyone who gets assaulted is entitled to five payments. Who becomes the beneficiary of those five payments? So the Mishnah over here only speaks of two of the five payments. There are three more to speak about. We'll speak about them quickly, but first let's do with the ones the Mishnah talks about. Boshto pagam shalom. So the Mishnah describes their boshes and pagam. Boshes is the embarrassment that she suffered, and pagam is the actual depreciation, meaning if she got a very serious injury and the injury is is going to continue. She loses an arm, a finger. In other words, it's a debilitating damage that she suffered. So then you have to pay for the actual depreciation. So the Tanna Kamma says that they belong to her. Boshes and Pagam belong to her. She's going to be the recipient of those payments. Let's for a moment just consider the other payments, although the Mishnah doesn't describe them. The other payments that go to somebody who is assaulted. Niske, we're talking about Niske Adam. So the tsar, pain. So the Mishnah doesn't discuss it, but that for sure, that clearly goes to her. Meaning she's the one who's experiencing the pain, so she's going to get that payment. Ripui, who gets the restitution of her medical bills? So that actually goes to the husband. Okay, the Mishnah doesn't mention that, but that goes to the husband. Why? Because it's the husband's obligation to heal his wife. You remember we learned earlier in the Masechta that when it comes to refuah is kind of like mizonos. Just like a husband has to feed his wife, husband also has to medically support his wife. So all doctor bills have to be paid by the husband. So if she gets assaulted and she gets hurt, and somebody's going to be paying her the ripui, so actually the husband gets that. That goes to the husband. But that doesn't matter. In other words, the husband has to take the money and obviously use it for a medical bill. The reason why the husband gets it is because he's responsible to take care of her. And finally, there's Shevis. And then there is her lack of productivity. So who does that belong to? So that also belongs to the husband. Because remember, the husband gets her productivity. So the husband gets her productivity. So now she's hurt and now she can't work. So who gets that productivity? So that goes to the husband. So Shevis, Ripui, and Tsar, the Mishnah doesn't mention, but like we just spent the Rishonim speak it out, by the way. I didn't invent any of these ideas. They're clear in terms of categorically where they go. Boshes and Pagam, which are the two topics which are discussed in the Mishnah, so that's not 100% clear. Well, what do I mean? The Mishnah made it pretty clear. Let's go on in the Mishnah. So the Mishnah says again, we're talking about Boshes and Pagam Shalah. So according to the Tanna Kamma, they belong to her. Rabbi Yehuda ben Beserah, Omer Mizman Shebeseser. So let's say she gets hit in a covered area. Now that's not the only way to say the Mishnah. There's another pshat in the Mishnah, but right now I'm just going to say it because Rashi's not abundantly clear, but Tosfos says it like the way I'm saying it. The Rambam says it like the way I'm saying it. So I'm going to offer this as a pshat in the Mishnah. So Bizman Shebeseser. So let's say she gets hit in a region where nobody sees. Okay, so it's a private area. So Lashnei Chalakim v'lo Echad. So there. The Boshes and Pagam is going to get divided. 66-33. Okay, you know, one third, two thirds. Okay, let's just keep it simple like that. One third, two thirds. So she's going to get two thirds of it, and he's going to get one third of the Boshes and Pagam if it's in a concealed area. Of his mancha begaloi. Now, what if it's in a revealed area? So a place that everyone could see. So lo shechalakim v'lach echad. So there also it's going to be one third, two third. The husband gets two thirds of the payment, and she gets one third of the payment. Shalom yinasei miyad. And in terms of the payments, how do they work? So he gets his portion immediately. Again, he's either getting a third or two thirds, depending on whether it's a concealed area or a revealed area. He'll get his money immediately. Vishalah. Now, but in terms of her money that she receives, yilak ichbem karka, that money should be rolled over into property. V'huachal peros. Now, she'll be the owner of that property, but he'll be entitled to the dividends of that property. That property produces any fruit. So then he'll be entitled to that fruit as well. Like any money that she gets over the course of the marriage, where again, she's the owner of that, but the husband is entitled to payers and to dividends. Okay, Adkan, that's the Mishnah. So again, the Mishnah, more on the topic of who goes to what, right? The Mitzias Aish and the Masi Adam go to the husband, the Yerusha, if she inherits property while they're married. So again, that's her property, but the husband get the peros of that property. So more on the topic of peros. And finally, if a woman is hit and she gets her five payments, so where do the five payments go to? So the Mishnah only discusses two of the five. We outside discuss the other three. And that's the good. The Mishnah basically telling us things that for the most part we knew already. It's really the Boshes and Pagam is really the only chiddush in the entire Mishnah. Gemara makes that point. Let's go to the Gemara right away. My Kamash Lantanin, the Gemara says, we learned this already in a Mishnah. We go way back into the Masechta, Daf Mem Zayin. the Mishnah says, "Av zakabibi tipik dushabik and sifashabibir." That in terms of the father's rights to the daughters, the father is entitled to accept kesef kiddushin, shtar bia, meaning he can marry his daughter off to whomever he wants, and through any of the three methods of kiddushin. We learned that earlier. And zakabimitsiyaseva masiyada. Also, the father's entitled to Mitzia and her earnings. Uvafarsadaran, the father can annul her vows. Mikabas Gita, the father accepts her ged. Remember, we discussed that earlier. We talked about where she only went through Erisin, not through Nisuin. Anyway, Vaino Chalperes Bechayeha. But the father doesn't need Peros. In other words, if there are any Peros of any property that she has, so the father doesn't need it. Nisays, now if she gets married, so now she is no longer under the domain of her father, but she's under now the domain of her husband. So yes, our love about Shuol Chalperes Bechayeha. So the husband gets all of the above, plus the husband is also able to eat the peros. So that's the mission that we saw approximately 20 days ago in the daf. So Gemara is bothered by a very simple question. So we didn't learn anything new in our Mishnah. So the Gemara, to which the Gemara says, "Boshta begamaitz derechlei plotted derabbi Yehuda ben Beser v'rabbanan." Gemara says, "Correct," meaning the beginning of the Mishnah is kind of just a setup, and really the end of the Mishnah, "Boshta begam," the machlok is between the Tanakam and Rabbi Yehuda ben Beser. In terms of who is the recipient of "Boshta begam," that's something that we have not learned earlier in the Masechta, and that's new. And for that point alone, dayenu. That's what the Mishnah is teaching us. Tanita Nakama de Rav, the following braisa was torn from a Rava. Mitzias Isha Latzma Rabbi Kivar Malabala. Okay, woman finds something. So we have it in our Mishnah that it goes to the husband, and the Mishnah is indiscriminate. The Mishnah just simply says it goes to the husband, period. However, in this braisa that we're learning now together, so the braisa says this is subject to a machlokas. According to the Tanakam, it stays with her, and Rabbi Kiva says it goes to the husband. Okay, and as we have it right now, things are going to change in just a moment. But as we have it right now, our mission is following the opinion of Rabbi Akiva. Good. Stay tuned. Amar le hashta uma ha'adafa demasi adehu amar Rabbi Akiva la'atzma mitzias alokol shekein. So the Gemara says we have to slow down for just a moment because we know. We learned already. According to Rabbi Akiva, not all her productivity goes to her husband. The ha'adafa demasi adeha. The additional, that which is above Ma'asei Yadeh. Ma'asei Yadeh, as we learned earlier, is her productivity. But her productivity, however, we don't mean that in the general sense, we mean that very specifically. We learned a couple days ago that there's an expectation of a woman when she's married that she's going to make a certain amount, she's going to spin a certain amount of wool, and that's going to go to her husband. And she's expected to make a certain amount over the course of a week. Okay, specific. The Mishnah is very specific in terms of the amount. Let's say she makes anything above and over that, so that's what's called hadafa, that's called extra. So who is entitled to the extra of her Ma'asei Yadayim? So Rabbi Akiva says she gets to keep it. How do we know that? So the Gemara says it's a Mishnah. So what the Gemara is about to argue, we're going to see the Mishnah in just a second, but what the Gemara is about to argue is, if she gets to keep the Hadafa of Ma'asei Yadeha, so that means that in general Rabbi Akiva is not of the opinion that everything that she does or earns or finds automatically goes to her husband. We see that according to Rabbi Akiva, she keeps things. For example, the Hadaf of Ma'asei Yadayim. So to which the Gemara is going to argue, if you see that Rabbi Akiva says that in general she keeps things, not everything, but she keeps some things, and we see there's a machlokas regarding Mitzia, wouldn't it make more sense, wouldn't it be more sensible to put Rabbi Akiva on the side of, well, if she's keeping her extra Ma'asei Yadeha, shouldn't she be keeping her Mitzia as well? That's the argument the Gemara is about to construct. First, let's go over a Mishnah. We've seen this Mishnah already a couple of times. We get to see the Mishnah again. Didnan. It's a Mishnah, Konim Shani Yos Laficha. A woman makes a neder and she says, you know what, enough with you taking the things that I make. My productivity should be usher to you. She ushers her Ma'asei Yadayim to her husband. So the Tanakhama says there's no need to be mefer, meaning we know that the husband has a right to exercise. Sorry, he can exercise his right to annul the vows of his wife. But according to the Tanakhama, he doesn't even need to, because she's not the owner of those items. He's the owner of those items. She can't forbid those items to her husband. So according to the Tanakhama, just it's. You don't, the husband doesn't even need to react. And Rabbi Kiva, Omer Yafir, and Rabbi Kiva says, no, he should be made for the neder. Why? Because it's true that the base Ma'aseh Yadayim go to the husband, but it's also true that there's hadafa, there's more that she creates, anything above the base amount that's being described earlier in the Mishnayos, so, and that goes to her. So that's something that can become prohibited to him if he doesn't exercise his right to annul the vow. So he should annul the vow so that the extra doesn't extra doesn't become forbidden to him. This Mishnah Nedarim has taught us, actually it's a Mishnah coming up later on, but this Mishnah has taught us that hadafa of a woman does not go to the husband, stays with her. Good. So Ella Epoch, so the Gemara says fine. So here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna switch around. So now a woman finds something, so there is a machlokas, but now we're switching around the positions, the principal positions, so that Rabbi Kiva has it go staying with her, and the Tanakhama says no, it goes to the husband. Now our Mishnah is going like the Tanakhama, and Rabbi Kiva is arguing with the Mishnah. And again, why is the Gemara think right now that Rabbi Kiva is arguing with our Mishnah? Because we know that according to Rabbi Akiva, the Hadafa Masiya does stay with her. So if there's an opinion that the Messiah stays with her as well, it's most probably Rabbi Akiva. The Gemara says, Vahak Yasav Rav and Amar Rav Yochanan. So the Gemara says, wait 1 second. Let's slow down, because even in this debate that we described regarding the Machlokas of the Tanakam and Rabbi Akiva regarding the Hadafa, the extra that she produces, so the Gemara says, on that we have the following debate. And that is let's say she's productive, but she's more than productive, meaning that she creates more than the base amount. To which the Gemara says, if it didn't take her any extra effort or exertion, see Rashi. Rashi says shlo yideh adcha kigon shaya iranis ubalas malacha. Let's say that she's just iranis. It's hard to put that into exact terms. But she basically is skilled and ubalas malacha, meaning she's just a workhorse, meaning she's productive. And for her, this wasn't a big deal, meaning she's producing, and not only is she producing the base amount, but she produces more than that, and she just doesn't rest. She's a worker. To which the Gemara says, if that's true, everyone's in agreement. There is not a machlokas between the Tanakama and Rabbi Akiva. Everyone's in agreement that goes to the husband. So ki pligi ba'adafa shal yidei adchak. The only debate is where she has to exert herself. Meaning this is not something that comes natural to her. She has to really go above and beyond what is expected in order to produce the extra. Then Rabbi Akiva and the Chachamim have a debate whether or not that goes to the husband or it stays by her. So Tanakama Savala Bala, Rabbi Akiva Savalatzma. That's the machlokes between the Tanakama and Rabbi Akiva. So what bothers the Gemara is the following. Let's see if we can follow now the thought process of the Gemara. So now it comes out that if she is in principle a worker, and she's an earner, and she's productive, and for her it's not a big deal to produce more than that which is expected, all that goes to the husband, not a machlokas. Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi and the Chachamim don't debate that issue. Well, the only area where they debate is Ayideh Adchak, where it was exertion, where it's extra exertion in order to create that hadaf. Rabbi Kiva says she gets to keep it, and the Chachamim say, no, she doesn't. That goes, that too goes to the husband as well. Now the Gemara says, so just think about what we try to do and not what we're trying to do. We try to suggest that it's the same Rabbi Kiva who must hold that the mitziah that she finds stays with her. It's not really comparable. Right now, this is what the Gemara is thinking. It's not really comparable. The mitziah, what does that mean? She's walking, she looks down, she finds a $100 bill, she picks it up. That didn't take a lot of effort. That wasn't a lot of exertion. And the way we have it set up now is that according to Rav Yochanan, when something comes to her without much exertion, so then everyone's in agreement, kuliyama lo pligi, that it goes to the husband. So how can you now suggest that it's Rabbi Akiva who says that the mitziah that she finds stays with her, when meanwhile, according to Rav Yochanan, everyone agrees that if it's well, now Masi Yadah, not Mitziah, but Masi Yadah, Shalai Yadah Tchak, should go to the husband. And nobody argues on that point. So how can you compare Mitziah to Masi Yadah, Shalai Yadah Tchak? That's basically the Gemara's question. Amar Papa, the Gemara gives a really interesting answer. Mitziah Saka Dafa Shalai Yadah Tchak Dami. So the Gemara says we're going to have to change one of our one of our basic points of assumption. And that is that finding something is not as simple as I just made it out. Meaning I describe finding something as she's walking down and she's finding something. So the Gemara assumes, the Gemara here changes that assumption. No. Finding something is like somebody on the beach with one of those metal detectors. Meaning it's an effort to find something. Just to go back a week and think about when Bedikas Chametz, right? Looking for the Chametz, so, right? I'm going to guess most everyone didn't find anything, right? The right? It's hard to find things. And when you're actively looking for something, so it takes work, it takes effort, it takes exertion. So the Gemara says it is a fair comparison, meaning because her metzia is comparable to it required effort and exertion to find something. So that's why they are comparable. The Gemara thought they weren't, but now the Gemara is changing its base assumption. They are comparable, and the Gemara says fine. And that, now it works out very good. Just like Rabbi Kiva and the Chachamim argue about when it comes to her earnings or productivity, if it took her effort and energy to create more, so that she gets to keep according to Rabbi Kiva, Chachamim argue. So if she finds something, now again, we're changing our assumption, that also took effort and energy, and therefore according to Rabbi Kiva, she gets to keep it, and according to the Chachamim, it goes to her husband. Okay. Fine. Let's say she multitasks. Okay, a woman has a better ability to multitask than men do. So let's say she multitasks. Let's say she does two jobs at the same time. So where do we say over there? In other words, so those are two different incomes coming to her at the same time. So is that something where both of them go to the husband, or could she keep one of them? According to Rabbi Akiva. The Gemara then just, without answering the first question, just simply amps up the question. Let's say she's able to multitask. Let's say she does four jobs at the same time. Well, where do the earnings go? Take a look at Rashi. Rashi over here is not going to leave the Gemara uninterpreted. So Rashi says, what does that mean, three or four jobs at the same time? Shomer's kishuim. So Rashi over here describes how a woman can get five incomes at the same time. Number one, Rashi says, she's guarding the cucumber patch. Okay, the back of the yard. So if someone needs to sit there and watch it, good. So she sits there and watches. All right, that's already one income. V'tova pishtan, Rashi says, at the same time also, she's spinning linen. Good. So that's the second job that also is providing her an income. Number three, says Rashi, malam ishir l'nashim. Also, she's giving voice lessons to other women. So the bishar. So that's already now her third job that's producing her an income, and she's doing all this at the same time. And finally, also she's warming eggs. Okay, in other words, I guess fertilized eggs that need to be warmed, and so she's sitting on them and she's warming them. So again, so those are four different jobs that she's doing simultaneously. So the Gemara wants to know, so is that considered Ali Dei Hatchak, or is that not considered Ali Dei Hatchak? According to Rabbi Kiva, that would go to her, according to Rabbi Kiva, the Hadafa Idei Hatchak is retained by her. So when she's doing four jobs simultaneously, how do we consider that? Is that considered Ali Dei Hatchak? Take it, the Gemara leaves this question unresolved. There are two questions, really, that are unresolved in the Gemara, right? Hedy, I'm starting to think like you now. There are two questions, really, that are unresolved, meaning, on this machlokas between Rabbi Kiva and the Chachamim, who do we follow? So I saw in the notes that's not clear, meaning that itself is already a machlokas amongst the Rishonim. And even after we resolve that question, which we haven't, that's a machlokas, if she does two jobs simultaneously, or three or four jobs simultaneously, what happens to those extra incomes? Do they stay by her? Also, the Gemara leaves that question unresolved. So, a lot of unresolved issues. No, we're not talking about the actual threat. We're talking about the income that she gets while she's spinning, and that income, so it's subject to a debate whether or not she gets to keep it or that goes to the husband. Okay, Bosha Pagama, the Gemara goes on now, describing Bosha and Pagam. So, Maskev La Rava Barachana Nelmiata by Susasso Shachaver Hachanami Debai Lemitain La Boshas. So the Gemara over here asks a question now. As far as the actual question itself, so I know the Gemara is going to sound a little crass in terms of the way it presents it, but the idea of the question, however, is a very powerful idea. Meaning, what happened in our Mishnah? She was embarrassed. So where does the payment of that embarrassment go? So according to the Tanakhama, so she goes, she's the recipient of that boshes. But according to Rav Yehuda ben Beseira, no, she's not the recipient of that boshes, but rather, part of it goes to her and part of it goes to her husband, depending on where exactly she was hit. But in other words, the idea that part of it goes to her husband, that right now is what the Gemara is bothered by. How is it that she was embarrassed and the husband is going to get money for her for that embarrassment that she suffered? Much like I described in the Mishnah. The Mishnah didn't mention tsar, didn't mention pain. Why not? Pashut, it's obvious. In other words, she was the one who experienced the pain, so obviously that money goes to her. That goes without saying. So the Gemara, basically in a similar vein, is asking regarding the boshes. Now again, according to the Tanakhama, it's not even a question. Tanakhama says that she's the recipient of the boshes, so that's good. But according to Rav Yehuda ben Beseira, he gets a share of the boshes, either a third or two-thirds. And what bothers the Gemara now is that she's the one suffering the boshes. How is it possible to even envision that he should be receiving some portion of it? And the way the Gemara asked the question is, let's say your horse gets embarrassed. So the right, boshes. So now the man's horse gets embarrassed. So now are you really expected to get pay the owner of the horse for the embarrassment that the horse suffered?
Wait, how does the horse get embarrassed?
Well, that's going to be the Gemara's very next question, which is the Gemara is, right. That's the obvious question the Gemara is about to ask it. But what the Gemara is just setting us up is structurally, how can one, in this case horse, but how can one person get embarrassed and somebody else become the beneficiary of that payment? So the Gemara says, Vesus bar boshes. So the Gemara says, just in terms of an example, it seems to be a poor example as a horse doesn't actually experience embarrassment. So Ela Rakak Bibigdosha Chaver Hakanami Dabai Lemitele Boshes. So the Gemara says, okay. So Gemara says, fine. Now, that example wasn't the best example, so let's do another example. But again, we're asking essentially the same question. How can one person be embarrassed and somebody else become the recipient of that money? So the Gemara says, let's say you spin on somebody else's clothing. So are you expected then to give the boshes? The Mishnah in Bava Kamma, this is in the 8th Perek, describes where, let's say you spit, and the spit gets makes contact with the person that you spat on, or let's say you uncover the hair of a woman, or let's say you remove the clothing off somebody. So that person experienced embarrassment. So you have to pay him arba mezuz, 400 zuz. Right? It's not an objective amount in terms of how much embarrassment you pay. It really, the Mishnah over here is just giving us like some sort of example, but really depends on who's embarrassing, who's being embarrassed. But either way, the amar of papa. But you got to read on. Lo shano labo. That's only when you spit somebody. The spit that you hurl at the person actually makes contact with the actual person himself. Avav be big do potter. But if you spit on somebody's clothing, so then you're going to be exempt. So, bebigdo le se zilusa, ishto isle zilusa. So the Gemara says like this. Somebody spits on your clothing, so there's not going to be any boshes. And the reason is very simple. Because that's my clothing, that's not me. Meaning, what are you going to say? My clothing got embarrassed? Right? That's not subject to embarrassment. But if somebody spits on my wife, so that's a personal affront to me. So the Gemara says, interesting. We have in the Gemara is la zilusa, but really the point of the Gemara, and you'll see the correction on the side. The Gemara, the Rav Yaakov Emden makes this correction, and that is le zilusa. When a woman is spat on and it's not her clothing, she spat on, so then it's the husband who's really suffering the embarrassment. So that's why, according to Rav Yehuda ben Beseira, the husband is going to be receiving a portion of that payment. So Amalei Rav Yehuda Rav Asher Lameyata Bayishani Ben Tovim Dislei Zilusa Lekula Bnei Mishpacha Hachanami Dabai Lemitin Lehu Boshes. So the Gemara says, let's say someone comes from a family, and the family that he comes from is a very wealthy family, but happens to be that this particular person is indigent. But he gets spat on. And you want to tell me now that the family's entitled to boshes because he got spat on and it's embarrassing to us. And we know that's not the halacha. The halacha is that only the principal person who got embarrassed, only that person becomes the recipient of the money. So what kind of argument are we making now that because the husband suffers an indignation when his wife gets spat on, so therefore he's entitled to the money? That's generally not how it works. So the Gemara says, Amalei Hasam Lav Gufayu. So the Gemara says, as far as family members are concerned, they're not him. The only time you pay boshes is to the principal person who was embarrassed. But hachi shoku gufei have. But over here we're talking about a husband and wife. A husband and wife, they become one. They become one unified entity, and so therefore an embarrassment suffered by the wife is in fact an embarrassment that's suffered by the husband. Meaning, we're speaking in really halachic terms. Meaning, I understand sympathy, empathy, but we're speaking halachic terms. In halachic terms, so when the wife is spat on, so she is an extension of him as a married couple, as a unit now, and so therefore he's actually going to be suffering some of that indignation. So, right, it's like... The Gemara is trying to make a beautiful idea, but in doing so, you understand that from a financial basis, it's a beautiful idea, but from a financial basis, that means that when a person's wife is suffering embarrassment, so that really means that you're the one suffering the embarrassment, and, again, beautiful idea, but translates that into finances. What does that mean? And that means that you're going to be receiving actually some of the boshes. Meaning, it's not that it's my wife being embarrassed, it's I'm being embarrassed as a function of my wife being embarrassed, and ishto kagufo, meaning we're not two entities, we're one unit, and therefore I'm entitled to some of the payment. How much are we talking about? So again, there's a third or two thirds, depending on where exactly it was.
No.
In other words, I know, but we're not discussing. We're just discussing a simple case where she's the one who was embarrassed.
What about the husband? The husband is also suffering, so he should make two payments.
I do understand that, but no. In other words, in terms of the nezik that's done, only one person was nezik. The only issue now is becoming who's the recipient of that money. I understand where your question's from, but ultimately it's one person who was damaged. And that one person that's damaged, and now it's just a question of cutting up the pie. You want to increase the pie, but the pie is still, it's still going to be the same pie. It's one person that's damaged, just a question of who's going to be the recipient of it. Okay. The Mishnah, now we are starting the next Mishnah. We're in Samach Vav Amidalef, the next Mishnah, second Mishnah of the Perek. These Mishnahs are going to be very interesting. They're going to be discussing the dowry and various menhagim. Now, every marriage has finances that are involved in them. Nowadays, the finances really revolve around the actual wedding itself. But back then, the wedding was also significant, but if equal, if not more significant, is the dowry. Meaning that there's going to be a contractual obligation that exists between the husband and the wife, really between the father-in-law and his son-in-law, regarding a dowry that he writes. In other words, you're going to marry my daughter, and just to make it, you know, more appealing, I mean, she's already appealing enough, understood, but to make it more appealing, however, I'm going to contribute to the wedding, going to contribute to the cause. And so he writes a dowry for his daughter. And remember, we discussed earlier, what happens is that whatever value he brings into the marriage, you're going to write into the ksuva. It's going to be contractually obligated. At what point does he actually receive the money? So the answer is nisuin. Meaning, generally speaking, that dowry, whatever that dowry amount is agreed to, that's going to be, he's going to become the recipient of nisuin. So that means that if that, at Erisin, right, he betroths the woman, and now Arus Varusa, they're at the first stage of marriage. So there's no financial obligations, and also he does not become the recipient of a dowry. If the father-in-law says to his son-in-law at that point in time, look, I'm looking forward to the marriage, and here we go, I'm going to commit myself to speak in modern terminology, $10,000, $20,000 into the marriage. So that's a commitment. And when exactly does he receive that money? So the answer is going to be at nisuin, at the second stage of marriage. I'm giving a modern example. It's kind of difficult because nowadays eris and nisuin all occur at the same time. With that stated, there are a number of very interesting menhagim that occurred, and we're going to be learning over the course of this Mishnah and the next Mishnah some of these menhagim. So we start with a Mishnah. Aposik Masa Chasno, a person agrees, commits himself to a certain amount with his son-in-law. And umeis chasno. So, and then God forbid, his son-in-law dies. But it happens, his son-in-law dies. And now, and let's assume right now that the only thing that occurred is erusin. So although he committed himself to the money, but he didn't actually acquire the money because then he goes to the second stage of marriage. And now all you have right now is a commitment to a son-in-law who's dead. But to make the story a little more interesting, so now there's a surviving brother. And that surviving brother has the mitzvah of Yibum. And so now the surviving brother turns to his now father-in-law. Okay, in other words, it's strange, but he wasn't that wasn't supposed to happen. But Kadosh Baruch Hu, in his ultimate design, designed that this is supposed to happen. And so now the brother-in-law turns on the father-in-law, says, "I know you weren't expecting me, but you made a commitment to my brother. So do we get to keep that commitment?" The Mishnah says the father-in-law doesn't have to keep the commitment. Amru chachamim yachul shayomar la'achicha shayomar, sorry, la'achicha yiti rotze litein v'lach yafshi litein. The father is within his right to say, "Look, I made that kind of commitment, but I liked him. He was a good guy." And in fact, we're going to see later in the Gemara, and you can't make any assumptions about who people likes and who people don't like. Meaning, let's say the brother who died wasn't a Talmud Chacham. Let's say the surviving brother is a Talmud Chacham. The Gemara is going to say this. So even still, the father-in-law can say, "I liked him. I was ready to make that kind of commitment to him." You, on the other hand, I don't know you, or can even say it stronger, "I don't like you." In other words, he does not have to keep that commitment if it's somebody else who's about to marry his daughter. Okay, that's point number one in the Mishnah. Point number two of the Mishnah. Paska lahachnis lo elef dinar, hu poste kenegdo chamesh esrei manen. Very interesting halacha. And that is as follows. There is going to be... Now, I know interest is going to become an issue, and I want to try to avoid it. So I'll just avoid it by not saying the word interest. Okay, and I understand a lot of you are going to wonder, well, why isn't this going to be a problem of interest? So right now, I'm going to sidestep. But the halacha goes like this. If, let's say, he commits himself to a thousand dinar, a thousand zuz. Same thing. In other words, he's going to put into the money. He's going to put into the marriage money. Okay, not gifts. Not, in other words, just actual money, venture capital. The father-in-law is going to put into the marriage. So, what the husband at that point has to do is the following: when he writes a ksuva, so he's got to tack on another 50% over that which he actually received. Take a look at Rashi. Rashi writes, Yachol Shiomar, sorry, who posted connected in Tesvav Mana? Shlish Yoser Yikable Malav. Now Rashi over here describes it as a third. Again, in terms of fractions, it can go either one of two ways. It can either be a half or it can be a third, depending on whether you're looking at the original or you're looking at the end product. Either way, let's just deal with the actual numbers. It always makes it easier to see it. In other words, if the father-in-law injects $1,000 into the marriage, 1,000 zuz, so what the husband's going to do is he's going to write in the ksuva that he received 1,500. Shu mosef lefishim istakar b'hem elef dinar, hein asara mana. So, and the reason why is because when given venture capital, so what do you do with venture capital? So you make business out of it. You turn around and make a business. So therefore, what the husband is writing into the ksuva is, "Look, I really appreciate you giving me 1,000. So what he writes into the ksuvas is as if he received 1,500. Because even though the husband actually only received 1,000, but still the idea is that he can make that money work for him. And that really will be the venture capital that starts off their life together. Him and his wife, his father-in-law, allowed him at the beginning of the marriage to start with a certain amount of money. Great. He'll invest. He'll make business out of it. Right? Again, he's got to be prudent, and I understand youth is not always favorable to prudent use of money, but what he writes in the ksuva is above a 50% surcharge, if you will, for the venture capital that's given to him by his father-in-law. So I knew that was coming. So it's not, and probably this is why it's not interest. And the answer is no, it's not interest, because the Mishnah doesn't whisper a word about interest, nor does the Gemara. quite honestly, nor does Rashi on this entire sugya. And the reason why it's not interest probably is because, remember, the ksuva is not, it's not a loan, meaning, well, the dowry is not something where the father's putting in and he's going to pay it back at a later point in time. It may be that he's never going to pay it back. Remember, dowry is something that he may keep indefinitely. If she predeceases him, then all that money goes to him. Okay. So, and more than that, is that the, what is interest? Interest is when I get money, money plus time, right? Is usually your basic recipe for interest. Over here, it could be, no one's wishing it, but it could very well be that the marriage will disintegrate immediately. And if that's true, so then he's going to be paying back the money immediately. Interest is only money plus time.
But he can lose money too. I don't understand. Why would he write 1,500 when he can lose that also?
Well, of course he could lose it. So, and?
So why is he writing 1,500?
Because that's, that. In other words, as an appreciation for the money that was invested by the father into the, by the father-in-law to the marriage, so he's going to add on more. Again, he's getting, this is money we're talking about. That money can go to work for him right away. So it's a form of appreciation. This is the minhag that was done back then in terms of actual cash. Okay, neged ashumo posik pchos chomish pchos chomish. So and then the Mishnah goes on to another point, and that is the following. You know, when it comes to shiduchim, so I'm just saying this by way of example. When it comes to shiduchim, so the way that it's normally presented is that. You know, everyone's always the best. In other words, this girl's the greatest, this girl's the best, that guy, he's unbelievable. And you know, just in general, whenever you try to create shidduchim, so there's always going to be an exaggeration. That's true regarding the people, and it's also going to be true regarding any of the dowry that goes in. Meaning that basically, at the at this negotiation table between the father-in-law and the son-in-law, and the father-in-law and his mechutin, so there's going to be, you know, I'm going to throw in a car. And it's not just a good car, it's a great car. It's unbelievable. It's going to be the best car ever. There is an assumed exaggeration of all goods that the father-in-law goes and puts into the marriage. So, when the father-in-law puts anything into the marriage, and it's appraised at this table, at that sit-down, at that table, it's assumed that there's an exaggeration. And that assumed exaggeration is how much? 20%. So when the husband now writes anything into the ksuva document, you know, I received this, so he can actually deduct 20% of the appraised value, because we know everyone's speaking hyperbole at the shidduch, at this arrangement.
Does it apply to when describing the people too? There, it's an exaggeration by 20% too.
Yeah, probably more. Yeah. Okay, I don't want to say this on tape. Ask me afterwards. I'll tell you a great story about people being appraised. The shum b'mana v'shava b'mana in le'elamana. So if the appraises a mana and it actually is and it actually equals a mana in le'elamana, and then the Mishnah points out that if there was no exaggeration, if it really was the actual value, so then you put into the ksuva mana. Now, I don't know what to do with that line of the Mishnah, because the Mishnah says that your default assumption is going to generally be that things get exaggerated at the shidduch. So this line of Mishnah is talking about when it was appraised before, or maybe it was after. I'm not really sure. In other words, but if its actual value is a money, so then you put a money into the ksuba. And then what the Mishnah over is going to do now from this point going forward is just give other examples. As if we couldn't figure all this out. And the Gemara is going to be bothered by, we got the basic idea, and now just more examples with that, that'll illustrate this idea. So let's say it's appraised at a mana. So what does he do? Shloshim ve'echad stela v'dinar. So he puts in 31 stela and a dinar. Remember 31, I'm sorry, every stela is 4 dinarim. So 31 times 4. 120. And another, right, the, so,
124.
Right, I'm sorry, right, thank you, 124. So in other words, if the appraised value was a mana, so she's got to put in 124. And again, the idea is that there's going to be a general assumption that things are going to be exaggerated in terms of how it's valued. And so she's got to put in 124 because they're going to exaggerate the value of that item. And just another example. If let's say 400, so she's got to put 500 in. Okay, again, because when she puts in 500 of, again, we're not talking about money. We're talking about of goods. 500 zuz of goods, again, the assumption is that it's not really 500 zuz, it's really 400 zuz, and we're just adjusting for the exaggerated value that's done at the shidduch. Another example. And whatever the husband agrees to, so it's really going to be 20% less than that. And again, it's just the same idea, just repeating itself in the Mishnah. Tanu Rabbanan. And like I mentioned earlier in the Mishnah, we're talking about the first case in the Mishnah, where the father-in-law commits himself to a certain amount of money to inject into this marriage between his daughter and that guy, unfortunately died after Erisin, and now there's a Yibum possibility, and he can say to his next son-in-law, not you, I'm not going to give you the money, and the Gemara just simply is highlighting, even if that second son-in-law is a Tamei Chacham, the first one was an Amah Aretz, the second one's a Tamei Chacham, still, he could say to the second one, I don't like you. Meaning, again, I don't like you, we're speaking in halachic sense, meaning I'm not ready to commit that kind of money to you. The first guy, I trusted. I think he could have done good with that money. You, okay, you're going to marry my daughter, I understand that, but I'm not going to give you that kind of money to work with. I don't trust you. Paskalach neso elav dinar so hainu reisha so tanishuma ramba v'ketanishuma zuta tanishuma dide v'ketanishuma dida. And the Gemara just simply very quickly explains why all the examples in the Mishnah. The Gemara says, I'll tell you why all the examples, because the Mishnah over here is just giving different examples, large amount, small amount. I might have thought that that maybe there's not an exaggerated appraisal if it's a small amount. The Gemara is telling us, no, that's not true. Even for a small amount, there's an exaggerated appraisal. What if he sets the money and then she comes in with the goods afterwards? Still, there's going to be an exaggerated appraisal. In other words, generally speaking, there's going to be an exaggerated appraisal. It doesn't matter if it's large, if it's small, it doesn't matter if she initiates or he initiates. Next Mishnah. Paskal achnasok safayim sala nasa shisha dinarim. More examples of the same idea. We're back to cash. And remember, when it comes to cash, so what he has to do is he has to tack on another 50% above the cash that the father-in-law injects into the marriage. So let's say, if the father-in-law says, I'm going to give you a sela, so that becomes, now one sela is 4 dinarim, so the husband has to write into the ksuva, 6 dinarim, meaning 50% above. Hachas mekabel alav 10 dinarim lekupa lechol mana umana. Rav Shimon Gamliel omer hakol kemenag medina. And then there's a money back program. Okay, I'm just saying with this by way of example. You know, when you get a credit card and you spend money, so the credit cards incentivize us to spending money. How do they do that? So money back. So we get 1%. I can do this by heart now, right? 1% on all purchases. 2% for restaurants. 3% for gas. Oh my gosh, those commercials are so good. They really train us well. So anyway, so she also gets a money back program. So asara dinarim lekupa. So for every for every dollar that the husband gets as part of the dowry, so an extra 10% of it goes back to her, the daughter. So for having such a wealthy father, for having the wealthy father commit to such a dowry, so 10% kickback goes to the daughter, and it goes for right now the Mishnah describes as a kupa. Stay tuned, as I'll explain what that means in just a moment. The Gemara will. Rav Shimon Gamliel, Omer HaKol Kemenag HaMedina, according to Rav Shimon Gamliel, so this isn't an exact science. You follow the customs of the community, meaning that'll dictate how much he's getting as a kickback. So Hainu Pose Kenegdam Chamisha Sarmana. So once again, what bothers the Gemara is just more examples of the same. Okay, we get it? Cash is being injected by the father-in-law, so he has to write that money plus another 50%. Goods, so again, there's an assumption of an exaggeration of its appraisal, so you get to write into the ksuva 20% less. And just again, more examples are the same. So Taniska Rabba Vataniska Zuta. So the Gemara says the reason why the Mishnah is giving so many examples when it comes to cash is because we want examples of large cash investment into the marriage, small cash investment. Utsricha di'itana iska rabba, because if we're talking about large capital being invested by the father-in-law into the marriage, so I might have thought, denafish ravcha. So there, you're dealing with a large venture capital investment into the marriage, so now this new husband has a chance of making a lot of money. So good. So he'll run into the ksuva. Let's say he gets a large sum of money, $100,000, so he'll run into the ksuva, $150,000. Fine. In other words, again, because he's already starting his life now with a lot of venture capital to operate and a lot of chance to profit. Aval iska zuta. But if we're talking about a small amount of money, the zuta rav chaim alo. I might have thought that we're just dealing with a small amount of money. He's not going to be making a lot of money, so he doesn't have to tack on another 50% into the ksuva. So that's what I might have thought. V'yashminin iska zuta, the zuta ziyuna, aval iska rabba, den rav ziyuna, me lo tzricha. And you can also argue in the other direction. And the way you'd argue in the other direction is if you're given small venture capital, okay, so a couple small investments. If you're given large venture capital, so that means then that you're going to have to work on big projects. Big projects require great risk, require great investment. In other words, it's true you have a chance of making a lot more money, but at the same time, there's also a lot of more risk and a lot more a lot more mouths to feed when working on a large project. And so it may not be expected for the husband to go and still continue to write 50% above the actual cash capital that he received from his father-in-law. Kamashman, the Gemara, the Chiddush is, it doesn't matter. What the amount is, any dollar amount that the father-in-law puts into the marriage, the husband has to write into the ksuva 50% above it. Period. Hachas mekabel lav asar dina lekupa, my kupa meravashi kupa shel besamim. So the Gemara says when she gets a kickback from the money that goes in, she gets 10% kickback. So what is she getting? She's getting besamim, perfume. V'amaravashi lo nemer dvar malal lebiushalayim. And interestingly enough, this minhag was only in Yerushalayim. And just as more interesting point, by the way, you can see Tosos, where Tosos is bothered by the idea that Yerushalayim already smelled great from the Ketores that was burned in Yerushalayim. And he quotes the Gemara in Yuma and see Tosos for that discussion. By Rav Ashi b'mana anishim b'mana miskaba. Now, we'll end off today with a couple of very basic questions. She gets a 10% kickback. Now, remember that there are two dollar amounts. The actual money that is invested by the father-in-law into the marriage and the amount that's written into the ksuva. And they're not the same. He's writing 50% more than what's actually being invested. So when she gets a 10% kickback, so which one is it? Is it b'mana nishom or b'mana miskabel? In terms of b'mana miskabel, yom rishon ol kol yom v'yom. And what are we talking about? Are we talking about a one-time 10% kickback? Or is this on a daily basis? And in Tzim Tzolom, we call Yom V'Yom, Shabbos Rishon, or call Shabbos V'Shabbos. And if we go more than one day, is it a week? Is it every week? In Tzim Tzolom, we call Shabbos V'Shabbos, Chodesh Rishon, or call Chodesh V'Chodesh. And even if it's weekly, is it a weekly up to a month, or is it go even beyond that? In Tzim Tzolom, we call Chodesh V'Chodesh, Shana Rishon, or call Shana V'Shana. And even if it goes beyond a month, is it just for the first year, meaning the Shana Rishon of marriage, or does it even go beyond that point in time? Teiku, the Gemara leaves this question unresolved, meaning the Mishnah does not give us a lot of clarity in terms of how this 10% kickback works for the girl. And for this, we'll just get to the two dots. We'll finish up to the two dots. Teiku. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav Maisa Bebito Shadakimam Ben Gurion. Should sound familiar, as in yesterday's daf. We just went over a story very similar. But remember, in yesterday's daf, if you want to be very specific, yesterday we talked about the daughter-in-law of Nachdima Ben-Gurion. Here we're talking about the actual daughter of Nachdima Ben-Gurion, very wealthy philanthropist living at the end of Beit Sheni in Yerushalayim. Shepaskal ha-chachamim arba meot zehuvim l'kupa shel besamim. So she got 400 gold coins as her kickback for her kupa shel besamim l'baba yom amr lahem kach tefsuku livno sechem. And when receiving such a kickback for having her father inject so much money, so much capital into the marriage, so she gave her a bracha to the chachamim. She said, same to your daughters, va'anu achareha, amen. And the response was amen. Contrast that to yesterday's story. You remember yesterday's story regarding the daughter-in-law? The daughter-in-law also gave a bracha to the chachamim, but they didn't say amen. And if you remember in yesterday's daf, The reason why she didn't say amen because at the time she was a shomer yavam, which means that she was a widow, and they didn't want their amen to go on every aspect of her life. So therefore, in yesterday's daf by the daughter-in-law, she refused to say amen. Today, however, regarding the daughter, they did say amen.
Okay, where and when tomorrow?
Okay, tomorrow.